One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
The following is a presentation of the Four Center podcast feed.
From the center of the galaxy, this is the Four Center podcast feed. I'm Ken Napsack.
And I'm Joseph Scrimshaw, and this is one of our News and Cues episodes. The Cues stands for questions, and the News stands for news, because that's the word it is.
That is the word it is. News. What a wonderful word. And questions. Well, we've got some great ones, as always. Before we get to all that, we're going to remind you that today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/4center. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. A little bit later, as always, we'll have a 4center recommends an audiobook we think you should try out on us. And we're not done there, Joseph.
No, we are not. We also have an offer from Insight Editions. They are a publisher of a bunch of great Star Wars books and other awesome pop culture books. They are offering 35% off across their website with a special 4Center code. To get your discount, you can enter the coupon code FC35, or you can visit the website with this link, insighteditions.com/discount/FC35. This week, we are continuing to recommend the Insight Editions book, Secrets of the Jedi. It's got these great little fold-out notes where you can learn Ourobesh, and it feels like you are passing notes with Jedi in gym class. It's great. Check it out with the code FC35.
Check it out, indeed. And I bet if, like, Aura Besh was more, you know, more known when we grew up. You know, it was something we had conversations about in 85. But I bet if it was for me, I would have learned it and probably written notes in class to friends in Aura Besh.
I think that's part of why I'm so excited about it and obsessed with that particular element of the book. The whole book is great, but like, yeah, I mean, especially when I was younger, like I had some time to fill. I would have spent a summer learning Aura Besh.
Yeah, and I'm always impressed with the folks. Alex Damon is one of them that could kind of almost translate it on the fly, like it's a second language. Just they can read it, and I love it. But so yeah, I myself have to dive more into Secrets of the Jedi book, a great book I do own, and just teach myself. It's like going to Burbank night school for me, I guess.
Yeah, you know, my wife's been doing Duolingo, so she does her French at night. So when we're getting kind of ready for bed, I was like, "Have you done your French?" And I can start saying, "I'm going to do my Aura Besh."
Okay, perfect. This is a mirror image thing going on here, because that is Grace every day too. Oh, I can't have dinner yet. I got to finish my French. So you know what? Maybe I'll be in the corner. Maybe you and I learn this. Sarah and Grace can speak French fluently to each other.
This is great. We can have a double date where none of us are speaking our primary language.
Love it. Love it indeed. That would be a Star Wars and life adventure, which is what we love chatting about here. Joseph, I got to tell you, I forgot to warn you. I got almost a grumpy one, but it's going to be good. But stand by for that. But how's your Star Wars adventures and life going?
Star Wars adventures are great. Life adventures are great. Two fun smaller things. The great Star Wars designer, I just wanted to shout out, if people aren't following him, Jake Lunt Davies. His Twitter handle is just at Jake Lunt Davies. He put out this, I'm just going to read his tweet, concept sketches for what would become crooner Lulilo Primock on Dryden's Yacht and Solo. Oh. Began life as the usual gun-toting bounty hunter type character with the intention he'd be found at some bar playing sabacc via his remote control pincers. And it's just four drawings of good old Lulilo, Vat Weirdo, as I used to call him before he knew his name. And he's got these different vibes, because he's got this like, oh, I'm wasting my life in a crappy casino. But that's him. All the beauty is there, right there. And it was really nice. I saw this and I faved it and I bookmarked it and I was like, I'm going to respond to him. And then another wonderful Star Wars person, Phil Sostak, tweeted attention Joseph Grimshaw to make sure I saw Lulilo Primock. And it was just a really nice moment of Star Wars celebration. That nice moment where somebody else knows, you really like this. Make sure you see this.
I love it.
So I was able to respond and go, oh, amazing work, Jake Lunt Davies. Absolutely, truly one of my favorite designs, because it's so alien and weird, but somehow still like just so like real and relatable.
It is. It is. I love the Star Wars design world and just that community and those folks that kind of make up that world, from Phil, Doug Chang, anyone. They just all seem full of Star Wars joy.
Yeah, yeah. And so many people just, it's so cool that they're just like sharing the work and giving us some of these insights so we can understand better what they do. And then, you know, get a moment of just joy from some Vat Weirdo drawings.
That weirdo, still one of my greatest moments as a Star Wars fan, seeing Solo just a couple days before you, knowing you were about to learn, you were right.
A dream come true. Other adventure, I have not tweeted about this or put it on any social media, but the time for the change needed to come, and I have removed my Jedi in exile look. I cut my hair and shaved my beard. Huge thank you to everyone who said nice things.
Yes.
About that, it was just very much time for me. You know, part of it, the beard in particular, the beard and the hair, really for me, it really did help me process that part of the pandemic, to just kind of have a physical transformation that reflected that things are different, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people were really understanding about that, so it made me feel really comfortable with, you know, trying a different look, because it wasn't entirely my choice. Yeah. The hair part, I mean, the beard was, but the hair part was like, for a while, like, yeah, no, I'm not. It's either this or try cutting my hair myself, and not going to do that. So I really enjoyed it. And it was really kind that people said nice things. There's still some more images that will include that look out in the world. But it was just really time for me, practically for a couple of work things and emotionally. But this is the Star Wars part of it. I was kind of wrestling with like, but I need to commemorate it, right? Like before it all goes. And this total credit to my wife. She's like, well, you got your Jedi robe, right? So, and she was like, we'll drive around town. We can find Star Wars locations. We can go to a beach. It's like, and I was like, I don't need to do all that. But I did get out my Jedi robe and do a little photo shoot on my balcony with the Jedi hood up commemorating the beard before it went.
I love this. I always feel bad. I hope I didn't pressure you to keep it longer than you needed it. I was a big fan of it. I'm a big fan of looks. It comes quite frankly just directly from me being a Beatles fan and going, oh, that's McCartney's beard in spring of 1970. That's Lennon's beard from 1969. I just have that, you know, in me. So I love it. And yeah, it's commemorative or it's a commemorated, I should say, in an upcoming special Force Center release. We'll have more information soon on that one. So it's locked in time, but I totally get you too. It's a closing of a chapter. And I understand the emotional connection just last year and how you said, yeah, you process some stuff and going into a new season, and hair is definitely part of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, and it is the kind of thing of like practicing the Star Wars, you know, change is normal and you don't need to get too uptight about it. And they also those are things that can come back.
Yes. Yes.
So maybe they'll be back someday. But for now, back to old normal. Very weird. Very weird.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a great old Kids in the Hall sketch about Kevin McDonald growing a vacation beard. Now the beard kind of takes over, and I can relate to that as having some long, big, bushy beards in my life. It was hard to shave. Yeah,
yeah, but you are very good. You transition looks quickly and elegantly, and don't seem to fret about it too much.
I do. I document. I take pictures. Yeah, I fret a little bit more.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Yeah. You keep the fretting to yourself.
Yeah, and then when I can finally afford hair plugs and a wig, that's going to be the next final phase. Yeah.
So those are my fun Star Wars and life adventures. How about you?
Not much other than the Force Center work, except for this thing. And this one, I preface it by saying this might come off a little more grumpy, and I just sometimes I don't know. I can definitely be a curmudgeon. But I do go on Twitch sometimes, and I'll either build some Star Wars Lego sets or just hang out. And I just hung out, and I was talking. So people asked me about the upcoming film Dune and the trailer. And look, it looks great, and it's super cast. It's not something. And you're a big fan of David Lynch, and I know he took that big swing at Dune in the 80s, and it's not a super. I'm not super like, yeah, I got to rush out and see that. Right? It's just my honest take on it. It sounds quite frankly smug when I say it sometimes of like, look, I'm not a sci-fi fan. I'm a Star Wars fan, but that just, I'm here for Star Wars. I'm not here for sci-fi. And so someone left me a comment that rubbed me the wrong way. And I don't mean to call anyone out. I won't even say their name. And quite frankly, I don't know the username. It was a bunch of letters and numbers. But they said, Hey, you know, Ked, you know, kind of the, hey, big fan, butt kind of comment. You gotta check out Dune because Star Wars quote stole 90% of its stuff from Dune. And the started rubbing me the wrong way, but it turned me in on George Lucas himself and what he did. And I just feel, I don't like the use of that phrase, you know, stole from.
Yeah.
I feel George, correct me if I'm wrong, Joseph. I feel George has always been honest about his influences, number one, and two, why he chose specific influences to retell a myth for a new audience, where it is, you know, homages as well. But I mean, we're talking from Kurosawa and Hidden Fortress all the way to World War II dogfighting footage, as everyone knows. He wanted to take all this. And you always say, you're the first to really, for me in my life, to say, like, nostalgia is baked into Star Wars. Because that's George Lucas's stuff for all these influences, including the Dune novel, which what came in 1965, I believe, the first one in the series. And so it started in a little bit of, I hate that. I don't like that phrase, stole. It didn't steal from anything. it was, and it turned into a positive take of just reflecting on what George was trying to do. And I ruminated on it a little bit because I was in the gym, and sometimes I'll do some aggressive rumination in the gym.
Like aggressive negotiations. Aggressive like aggressive ruminations. I think that is, if not a t-shirt we make, because we've not been making a lot of new t-shirts, but a t-shirt in my mind.
Yeah, you know, you have the YouTube app up and you're like, should I respond? And by the way, the person, if you're listening, don't take offense. I think it comes from a good spot. You're a fan, especially if you're a fan of Dune and, hey, you're a fan of my work and maybe you want me to love what you love. But I've battled this a lot with Game of Thrones. I'm a Game of Thrones fan. I am not going to watch Witcher or Vikings or anything like that or Last Kingdom. I'm a Game of Thrones fan. And again, if I say it too much or too wrong, I really become comic book guy in The Simpsons. And I don't mean to be that. But so negative. I'm still a little like, I'm going to go work out in the gym a little bit to work through it. But I really reflected on George and how I even with the prequels too, you and I talk all the time about what he was drawn from. And we're going to have a great discussion about titles this week. And we're going to look at the prequels and those titles, which caused some controversy, caused some deep thoughts. You know, we got the modern era of Star Wars and a lot more people creating Star Wars and different kind of folks touching Star Wars. But when George, I think he was always honest about what he was trying to do and always honest that him as a film fan, as a myth fan, as just a human being trying to reach to and speak to a new generation. He wanted to draw from the things that were so successful in the past and say, let me repackage it. Let me put it together. Let me put my spin on this tale so that you can have another modern myth in your bag of books to read and films to watch.
Yeah, no, I could not agree with you more. I mean, I think I know what you're talking about. I think I have encountered that sometimes where a listener or a friend or a fan or anybody means it positively, right? If you like X, then you'll probably like Y. And I really like Y too. So it'd be great to hear your thoughts on Y or all that. I think it really does come from a positive place. But I also think it's important for you to be able to say, you're not out there saying Dune's stupid and people should only like Star Wars, right? You're just saying this is your, as an individual, your relationship with these media. And that to me is interesting, because then I immediately want to turn our whole podcast into an interview of like, interesting, you know, what is it about Star Wars and Game of Thrones that for them make it a different thing for you than it's not science fiction or fantasy. It's those specific, like, that's interesting, right? Because it's just your honest different perspective. So I understand where the commenter is coming from of wanting you to be excited about Dune.
Yeah.
But I also understand where you're coming from of like, but this is my honest truth. And I'm not saying anybody else is wrong, just saying my truth.
Yeah.
And then the thing about George Lucas, I mean, when you really just begin the history of Star Wars is, I'd like to make a Flash Gordon like I watched. Oh, the rights aren't available. And so the saga begins, right? Like that's the starting point, right? And then you get into all this, you know, where else was he? Was he inspired by? Where else was he? Did he draw from or reinterpret? And I think that for me is the finesse of this conversation is, I think a conversation about like what elements from Star Wars and Dune overlap, what elements of that may or may not have been intentional.
Mm-hmm.
What is zeitgeist? And then really, really, what is deep human truths that we wrestle with or try to verify? Are they truths? And they get baked into these great big storytelling worlds. And then when you really dig into them, you're like, oh, wow, these kinds are wrestling with the same thing. Like, it's not that one creator is stealing from another. It's, you know, kind of natural that lots of creators would really muse over change and chosen ones, you know?
Yeah.
And I am not super familiar with Dune at all. I've never read the books. I am not an expert. I recently rewatched the Lynch version of Dune. And like with many things, Lynch, you're like, oh, wow, cool, interesting. Some overlap here with Star Wars. But it's always the overlap is always not like Lucas saying, I don't know how to structure a story. I'll take Dune. It's
yeah,
it's these ancient mythic things and these big human themes we wrestle with that overlap to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And compliment it all together in his George-like way. Yeah. To say, there's spaceships and planets and emperors and resistances. They stole from it. You know, I get it. And again, yeah, you're so right. I want to focus on the positive. I didn't take it. I had it. That's why you go have some aggressive rumination. So you don't go firing off comments from people that that mean well. I really believe that. And yeah, anyways, it was, I just, you know, George Lucas has just gone on quite a journey as a creator, right?
Yeah.
Heralded, torn down, heralded again, and then torn down even more. Documentaries made about the people versus him. And then, you know, it's a ride, man. And through it all, he's just putting on jean shorts and going to museums and having fun being George. No one's crying for him, but I think he has a great way to handle it. But I just, he doesn't need my defense of him. But it just, it's there. It's there. And I love what he did.
Yeah. Final quick thing I'll say on this is like, we started out strong on 4Center recommending it a lot because we had read it recently. And sometimes we mention it still, but that How Star Wars Conquered the Universe by Chris Taylor, that is such a great read. Mm-hmm. And it took lots of bits and pieces of Lucas lore that I knew and really put them all together in a way that really highlights, I think, how Star Wars came about. And it's something that I talk about with other writers of like, I think Star Wars is a great example of take what you love and put it through your filter of who you are and dig in and find out why does that speak to me? And to me, that is the natural progression of generational storytelling.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, great point. And yeah, I love bringing up that book. Chris Taylor, great chap indeed. But that book, you know, because, you know, you pick a book and you're like, all right, yeah, what don't I know about the making of Star Wars at this point? So many books are on my coffee table right now, but making of these movies and George and Modesto and all these things. And yeah, Taylor put a fresh spin on it and did some wonderful things in the book. It's why we talk about it a lot here.
Yeah. Yeah. So good adventures, good aggressive rumination.
Yeah, there you go. Just sometimes you got to take a breath, folks. Just take a breath. All right. From there, speaking of big breaths, we're going to go into Star Wars news. Not a lot this week, not a lot going on, but that always sometimes gives us a chance to talk about little focused parts of the Star Wars galaxy. And we're going into this headline about Joel Edgerton on the secrecy of Kenobi. That's right. He was... speaking, I believe it was to comicbook.com or follow the hyperlinks until you find the actual core interview. They're out there. And as always, we always joke, but it's another Star Wars actor promoting another project. But then that turns into a Star Wars news bite. He was promoting The Green Knight out in theaters now. And he said this about Kenobi. Allow me to read this here. It's a longer quote. I'm unable to discuss the series and potentially totally as in the dark as you are. We all know the universe of Star Wars is on serious lockdown. Part of the reason for that is that people don't want the stories too spoiled before they come out. The great thing about Star Wars fans is that they are the creators of the next Star Wars universes, and I think that whoever's creating these things are creating them with the fans in mind. Note that they hold the keys to that universe. Deviate too far from what you might expect could mean death by lightsaber, and yet to not introduce surprises when that mix is death to creativity. You know, that's a journey. That quote's a journey. That's a journey.
That is one of the greatest quotes from an actor being not interviewed about Star Wars, but knowing he's going to be interviewed about Star Wars that I have ever heard.
I love it. Saying, look, we got to keep things secret. We don't want to disappoint fans. Another reason we get disappoint fans is, you know, we want to meet their expectations, but throw in some surprises to make everyone happy. Plus, they're going to be making Star Wars in the future, which is a little part of this thing I want to focus on, too. Just overall thoughts on the poetry of Joel Edgerton there.
Yeah, no, this is just so great because, like, even this weekend, not going to get into it, but there was a flare-up of, you know, some other actors not giving great quotes, given that some of those, why would you say that quotes?
Yeah.
And I think it is a part of the biz right now to be able to handle interviews, and especially if you're involved in a big thing like Star Wars or Marvel, knowing how to handle it, particularly when you're not actually being interviewed about it and you're trying to talk about something else. It just seemed like he was ready like a Jedi. Where he said, of course I can't talk about it, and then let me share with you why, and it's really philosophically beautiful too.
Yeah.
pretty impressive compared to some of the other things that have been said in interviews.
What do we think? The spoiler stuff we totally get. It makes sense there. And I think we would generally agree on the idea of, yeah, you do have to meet some expectations. It's Kenobi, man. But also something new, something exciting, whether it's an old character coming back or a completely new character or just some exciting plot points or twists. Yeah, we want that. I think we can get that there. But I love this thought on these shows being for the next generation of storytellers. Well, whether he meant that super, super literally, I don't know. But it's not untrue. And I don't know. There's something about that. I just kind of like thinking about that in that way.
Yeah, no, I think it kind of ties back to a little bit of what we were talking about with Lucas and him being inspired by what he loved and spoke to him as a child and as a young man. And then, you know, as a philosopher getting into, you know, Joseph Campbell and hero's journey stuff. I think that's great. And it's something that I hear being echoed in. You know, better or worse, we have a lot of, you know, universes that we're going to continue to tell stories in. It's Star Wars, Star Trek, Doctor Who, Game of Thrones, Lord of the Rings. Like that is, we have these versions of modern myths. And the actual history of myths is that they did get passed down and then reinvented by the next generation to reflect not only what they loved when they were kids about them, but also what is relevant to them now as adults, right? Yeah. And I think it's just savvy to be aware of that, you know, eventually, you know, right now, I think it is still a lot of people who grew up with the original trilogy. Mm-hmm. But now we're getting younger to it's people who like I grew up with the RPG. I grew up with Timothy Zahn, you know, but we're going to be getting into very soon, you know, Rebels is Star Wars to me. And that's, you know, that's my touch point, you know, and I'm creating from that perspective. So you have that perspective of love and continuity. But then I think you have this perspective also of a younger generation isn't just going to remake what they saw. They are going to try to add something new that makes sense to them, you know?
Yeah. No, it's all true. I love that focus point thing of just like, can you imagine when there's someone's going to tell a Star Wars story and they're like, yeah, Ezra was like the last Hope Jedi for me, right? There was this other guy came on, it was Kid Luke, I don't know, but Ezra was my first Jedi.
Yeah. So I think it's really great for him to be thinking about it that way, that these new things, especially, you know, Kenobi, who's going to speak to lots of different generations, people who grew up with original trilogy, prequel trilogy, you know, Kenobi's important to generation after generation of Star Wars. And you know, people who maybe saw Force Awakens first and said, who's that guy whispering to Rey?
Yeah.
So Kenobi in particular could be incredibly burdened with the, Are we pleasing people who are already fans? What a great perspective to say, what if this is the first thing anybody sees is Kenobi?
Yeah. And how do you get that point across and how do you got to be creative about that there? That's a great point about Kenobi of the many great points you've made about Kenobi over your life here on and off air. Kenobi is a like four quadrant Star Wars character, right? It's got original trilogy, prequel trilogy. A lot of other people are going to be like, oh yeah, Kenobi. So I don't want to say added pressure to the series. I think it's actually an advantage to the series.
Yeah, and I think that Star Wars is always wrestling with the new and old, and I think Filoni has spoken to this very eloquently. You got to find that balance of what makes it feel like Star Wars and makes it feel like it belongs in this galaxy and it belongs in this lineage, this literal timeline. But you got to keep adding new things and trying new things because that's a part of the spirit of Star Wars. Last thing I'll say on this, I've mentioned it before on the podcast, but it's always been such a powerful moment for me at a convention many years ago now. I heard Marv Wolfman talk. Marv Wolfman is a phenomenal and influential comic book writer. He wrote the comic that got me into comics, Teen Titans. He wrote the Crisis on Infinite Earths, which is, absolutely just industry-changing crossover event, multiverses, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, incredibly influential guy. And he was telling this story about how people who were, like, writing the Teen Titans then kept asking him, what do you think? And he kept responding, like, I don't know. I'm the old guy. Do something new. That's why I got into comics, because I was reading Green Lantern as a kid. And then I get mad and go like, well, why doesn't Green Lantern ever do X? So then I wanted to be a writer so I could make Green Lantern do the things I thought he should do.
Yeah.
And like that makes so much sense to me. I want Star Wars written by somebody who watched Rebels, loved the hell out of it, and then said, well, why didn't Kanan and Ezra ever do X? I'm going to write that.
Yeah. Yeah. And we are already in that era, but it, like you said, it's coming from the original trilogy kind of era, but now we're getting into some of the prequel era influence creators. And I really look at Acolyte with Leslie Headland about just, you know, what a wonderful different perspective she's going to bring to something familiar. Yeah, I'm with you on that. I can't wait to we get to that. The future of Star Wars is in good hands, just as long as they're not spoiled by Joel Edgerton in an interview. And he's not going to do that.
He's not doing it. Yeah.
Let's discuss a little bit. We have discussed this before, but I always think it's a good opportunity to discuss the upcoming Kenobi series. Uncle Owen and I want to include Aunt Beru in this discussion and our current hopes for things we might get to from those two characters, Joseph.
Yeah, I think there's this phenomenal possibility of the expected and the unexpected with Owen and Beru of things that really make sense and then like fun surprises. I think it makes sense that he might not know because I think Owen and Beru might be bookends, right? Mm. Some sort of squabble or encounter with the Lars or even with young Luke of Kenobi encountering the family near the beginning makes a ton of sense to just kind of reframe at this point in the timeline, you know, why is Kenobi not training Luke? How does he feel about it? You know, we know that Luke is aware of Kenobi, so it'd be fun to see a moment like that. So it really makes sense to set the table with an interaction between the Lars and Kenobi. And then, you know, the more I think about it, if everything that we've kind of theorized, the rematch of the century, the fact that Vader is there, if this is a story of Kenobi going off world to face his failure to either destroy Vader or rescue Anakin, and Obi-Wan basically goes on this, you know, midlife hero's journey where he returns to Tatooine changed, accepting from his point of view that Anakin can't be rescued and Luke is the chosen one. Luke is the new hope. There's got to be some sort of scene at the end that is the contrast to the scene at the beginning, right? Of how has Kenobi really come to peace with waiting to train Luke and with maybe even a more peaceful scene with Owen and Beru. Those are the possibilities that float through my head.
Yeah, definitely. I hadn't really thought specifically in terms of bookends, right? That'd be a pretty powerful bookend. And we've talked before about, you know, I think Uncle Owen, the Uncle Owen we see Phil Brown's version of him in New Hope is he's a grumpy authority figure and represents a lot of that. I was thinking about that relationship, the one we see in New Hope. And how we can maybe dive into that. I'm not expecting this to be the Owen and Beru show. I probably watch that as I think a lot of people listening would. But just the idea, Joseph, that they are light and dark, hope and fear, doubt and faith, and how they both want maybe the same result, the safety of Luke, but how Owen kind of sees it and it's kind of close to the vest and hides the cards he's playing with and is there to protect Luke, but almost like we see in The Bad Batch, the lessons that Sue LaQuane gives, Hunter, of, you know, the kids are going to go out. They're going to do stuff. They're going to get hurt. You just got to, you know, kind of let it happen and be there for them and guide them through all that kind of stuff. Of just, you kind of got Beru, like, you might not be able to stop what this is. And maybe they're not seeing it in terms of the hope for the galaxy, but the son of Vader, the son of Anakin, and how Beru might see that is who he is. And we got to figure the best way forward with that, with faith and hope versus, Uncle Owen withering in the sun going, no, we must hold on. I'm attached to this idea of this kid just kind of growing up safely and not being like that and pulling him as far as away as I can from that, which might start from a good spot, but ends up, a problem. So I would love to see that dealt with on any level.
Yeah, no, fear and hope is a great way to look at Owen and Beru, and it's all there in A New Hope, right? He's just not a farmer, you know? I love that, and I would love to see that. And the other thing that is sort of like right there on the table but would feel really new because we haven't like heard it verbalized is Owen and Beru really seeing Luke as not only like this charge, but like the connection to Shmi. You know, I think that's really would be really amazing to actually hear out of their mouths, right? Of like, we are, you know, he is the last vestige we have of this woman we loved, you know, and that is what is motivating our fear and our hope is to keep Shmi's, grandson safe.
I hope we get a lot of Shmi talk. I absolutely hope. You know, I'll take some Kleeg talk as well, but absolutely want some of that. Yeah. And Padme too. Come on, man. They got to have those conversations around the dinner table.
We just really want a large dinner table conversation about all of the great figures in Luke's life that he sadly doesn't know.
Yeah. Yeah. And then did we ever have a protocol droid? I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't listen to them.
We shall see. We shall see soon enough. Soon enough. So thank you, Joel Edgerton, for inspiring our Kenobi, Owen, and Beru conversation. Final story of the day is the tale of Lorna D is coming soon. This we know. We now have the voice cast list for Star Wars The High Republic Tempest Runner. This is new audio drama from Kevin Scott on the way August 31st. Just checking my notes there. Cast of voices was revealed. You can go to StarWars.com for the full cast list. Jessica Amalzi is the voice of Lorna D, the Nile Tempest Runner at the center of this story, and dare I say, the storm. So, Joseph, any highlights from the voice cast? A lot of veterans, Mark Thompson, Dan Bittner, a lot of people who get a lot of work doing this wonderful stuff. Any thoughts there before we get into the characters reveal?
No, the few names that I recognize, I know from this general world. I don't know a ton of the names, but honestly, that's my reaction. Is I'm really glad to see all of these voice actors who do this work continuing to do this work, because there are so many things where, you know, if you've got a bigger name,
yeah,
you get to do things. So there's a part of me that's like, I'm happy to see, these voice actors who know this work, continuing to get this work instead of suddenly, a movie star deciding they want to do that too.
Yeah, no, that's a good point and an unfortunate reality of the business there. So great names involved, but here's some of the characters, and I'm focusing on three here. Feel free to pull any that grab your attention too, Joseph. But and none of these characters are surprising. There's a lot of new characters we don't know. But I'm interested. This is the story of Lorna D, or a story based around Lorna D, and we're going to hear from her without a doubt. We got Jedi Keeve Trennis, Avar Kriss, and Markion Roe. Again, surprises? No, these are High Republic main characters. But I love the idea of getting more Avar Kriss. What's your thoughts on some of these characters coming our way?
Yeah, they all make a ton of sense to me. I think the fact that the sort of log line for this, the description is Lorna D wanting revenge on the Jedi. I think, some of these characters like Avar Kriss make sense. Markion Roe, of course, makes sense. There's some the other, Tempest Runners. That all makes sense. But I think I scanned the cast list for which Jedi is going to die.
Interesting. Oh,
because yeah. If it is set as Lorna D wants revenge, I think it is probably going to be a satisfying narrative if she gets it right.
Yeah.
So is it time to pour one out for Nib Asak, Yaga's a poor master, or or maybe a new Jedi that is being introduced that we don't recognize the name. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that was my reaction scanning the cast for who might not make it. I think Keeve Trennis is safe because she is the star of the High Republic comic right now. And I think Avar Kriss is safe. But
Yeah. But here's the thing. Here's the thing about what they're pulling off of the High Republic era. I don't think you're wrong at all. I think a Jedi could go, or a character could go. And it's not just I wouldn't expect this with other audio dramas. We've got the Afro one so far, the Dooku one, but it's almost like that's, we're going to do this little thing, this fun little thing in the corner. We're going to have some characters, in love, but I wouldn't expect, Santa Star Wars to be killed in an Afro audio drama. But the way High Republic is going, I wouldn't be surprised if a character death happens in a coloring book at this point.
Maybe not a children's book, but yeah, but a coloring book for sure. Like, oh, this is a sad page to color, but
turn the
page.
Has
to be done, kids. Yeah. Well, I think also Lorna D has always been portrayed as, an incredibly accomplished fighter. But man, did Rising Storm really be like, she seems to know her way around Jedi, know how to overwhelm them, and counter their martial arts abilities,
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm interested in this. Lorna D is a great character. She's key. And so far, I Markion Roe, we've definitely spent some time around him. I'm intrigued by turning the spotlight to a bad guy, if you will, someone on the bad team, the Nile here. Lorna D is really interesting. Twi'lek, if you will. I'm intrigued by the character, intrigued by what we learned in Rising Storm. And you're right, the log line is about revenge. And I don't think she's going to pull off that goal anytime soon. But I keep going back to this idea, and I just want to ask you, do you want or do you think at any point a character like Lorna D, or Lorna D specifically, will go quote unquote good? Will anyone leave the Nile? And is she being set up at all anyway? Because we're learning a lot more about her. Once you kind of learn some motivations, you might see where those motivations might change her along the way.
Yeah, I think this is a great way to think. I think that is a possibility in the long run. The nature of these audio dramas, right, are that there's going to be a forward-moving, exciting space adventure with some vengeance in it, probably. But they are very internal, right? They are literally often the monologues of the characters. And some of the casting suggests flashbacks, right? Kasav, right, is dead and going forward canon, right? So, and yeah. It sounds like a relative of Udaya D, right? So this sounds like it will be, honestly, like the two audios we've had have had a ton of introspection on characters that one could make an argument that they have some moral ambiguity, right?
Yeah.
Between Asajj Ventress, but why am I Dr. Aphra?
Yeah.
So I really think you're onto something there, because when we're spending this in this amount of internal intimate time with Lorna D, my questions are, okay, like, well, what shaped her? What does she truly want out of being a Tempest Runner? Does she have any belief in the structure of the Nile? Does she have a vision for the future of it? Or is the Nile just a means to her personal ends? And whenever we get an understanding of why a character wants what they do, even if it's something kind of awful, we warm to them a little bit, right? And that opens the door to the possibility of a story of change.
Yeah, exactly. We warm to them. Man, I just want to hang out with Darth Vader. He's good. I want him to go good. Yeah, no, it's real. And some of the, that's one of my favorite things about the Nile for me is just this idea that they're this super, super dangerously disenfranchised organization that every time we kind of get a little bit of motivations, I don't sympathize with them, and particularly where their choices are, but I can understand maybe where the path started, if that makes any sense. And so if we learn more about Lorna D or any of these Nile who start to maybe they themselves get answers or find peace or suddenly see through the lies that they're being riled up by Mark and Ro or just the Nile themselves and their push for power. If any of them are just going to have that moment of looking around and going, what are we doing? This isn't my intentions. This wasn't what is making me feel good. This wasn't what I want to do. If anything, I don't know. Lorna D just has some of that to me there. So not a prediction, not even a hope, just a big thought as they focus on this character so early on in the High Republic era.
Yeah, no, and I think so far she has been the one who has navigated the Nile and all of the changes that Mark and Ro is making the best, right? She has been the most savvy. And so that's a really interesting character to spend time with, to really be like, you know, what does she truly want out of the Nile?
Yeah, and final thing about her is, you know, cool design. And we know cool designs go far in Star Wars.
Yeah, that's right. And maybe she'll reflect on some of the horrible things she's already done, and we'll have to go through that tragedy again.
That's the second act of the drama story. Her just in jail going, man, I've done some things wrong. All right, we'll find out soon enough on August 31st. We will absolutely take a listen and discuss it here on Force Center. Before we take a quick break and get to your questions, we want to give you an audiobook recommendation. Joseph, what do we have?
We are staying in the world of the High Republic. This is one of the newest books. It is Out of the Shadows by Justina Ireland. We have physical copies that we are going to read. Eventually, we will discuss the book. But if you want to be all cut up, you can give Out of the Shadows a listen through Audible.
Do that by downloading your free audiobook today at audibletrial.com/ForceCenter. Again, that's audibletrial.com/ForceCenter, and pick up your free audiobook. All right, quick break on the other side. Your questions here on Force.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey, 4Center friends, make sure you're keeping up to date on all the great content from Jennifer Landa. Whether it's YouTube, Instagram, or TikTok, you whippersnappers, 4Center's own Jennifer Landa continues to bring you fun, informative, and insightful laughs and moments.
Also, Jennifer brings her experience and perspective as a Star Wars-loving mother to her DIY projects, blogs, and more. So be sure to head on over to JennyLanda.com, that's JennyLanda.com, for articles like how to make your own Darth Maul sneakers or 10 unique Star Wars baby gift ideas.
Follow Jen on Twitter and Instagram at Jennifer Landa and on TikTok as JenniferLanda1138. Welcome back to 4Center, the big show, the main show, the superstar destroyer of our fleet. Joseph, we've got some big questions to get to, so what do we have?
Yeah, we've got two questions from Twitter and two from our patrons on Patreon. We're going first to Twitter and Alejo. Alejo says, got an important question. I'm currently struggling. How many Star Wars items I have displayed in my home office? What is too much? If I need to put some away, what's the best storage? This is a very, very good and important question, and I think one that that listeners know you and I wrestle with all the time about not only home office, but everywhere that Star Wars can be displayed. What is too much? How do you handle storage? Ken, you've been going through some of this, so what are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's tough. I think you and I should pitch a Disney Plus show of, you know, like those Netflix shows. What's the one expert that gets you, throws out all your junk?
Marie Kondo, right?
There you go. Yeah, wants you to live with a table and a cup or whatever. I am the opposite of that. Not necessarily in a good way, but I think we do a Star Wars show about what do you do with all this stuff? You know what, Alejo? I think for me, it was paring down what has real significance, what absolutely represents things that I love in Star Wars, where some of it's just, you know, especially in the Force Awakens era, I was so excited. It was back, baby. It was back. I was just grabbing a ton of stuff and dumping them off the shelves into my cart and racing to the checkout. And I have since gone back and looked at some of that stuff and found that stuff to be easier to put in the box. There's no reason. I think once you realize the resale value is not great, like you grew up believing, I'm going to sell all my baseball cards and be a millionaire. Not so much. The days of, the rare vinyl Cape Jawa getting you a new house it's just not going to happen as much anymore. So I think once I personally was able to disconnect from, I'm not holding on to these for some investment later. I'm just holding on to them. I was able to either get rid of some stuff or put it away. And then again, find what has some emotional significance to me. And it could be something simple. I'm looking right now at one of the bombers from Last Jedi. I have the little micro machine display. I love that because that has a lot of meaning to me. And I love that sequence. And I love Paige Tico. And I love the slow motion. I love how Rian Johnson shot that little short film and inside another film. That means a lot to me. It's not just a Star Wars ship on my shelf. And right above that, I'm looking at a Lego Wampa because I love collecting Wampas. And I don't know why, but I do. And so it's those things that are specific now makes it easier to part or pack up the other.
Yeah, I think that's a great answer of just what is a symbol of your Star Wars love, if it is deep and meaningful or if it is just the purely aesthetic of, you know, you got an X-Wing and every time you look at it, it makes you smile a little bit. Like that's just the great test. That is sort of, I think, a little bit of Marie Kondo of like, does it spark Star Wars joy or Star Wars deep thoughts? Yeah. I think for me, like Leo's got this great question of, what is too much? And I think that is totally, totally up to you. I think for me, specifically on my home desk area where I'm sitting right now, too much is when I can't really move things around on my desk without accidentally knocking over Luke. That's too much. So all spots are filled right now on my home desk, but I have two Lukes. So very soon, I'm going to open one of my Leias and one of my Lukes is going to go somewhere else and Leia's going to come visit for a while. And for me, it is really like I have a lot of my Jedi friends that are both like just aesthetically cool, but also like have meaning for the characters, have meaning for when I bought those action figures or when I put them up in my desk. So I'm just kind of echoing Ken in my own way of what is the most meaningful to you is what I think you should keep.
Yeah. Yeah.
And do you have then, Ken, any advice on storage?
I'm a big believer in those plastic boxes. I call them plastic totes. You go to Target or something like that. And, I like that versus cardboard because you see, kids, cardboard will bring the cockroach eggs from your apartments. Don't move around the cardboard box. It's a Ken, old man Ken thing. So I just buy a lot of those. I buy a lot of the plastic ones and I seal them up. And I finally, I've had different living situations in LA over the years where there was one point I had a house with some roommates and we had a garage and all of our stuff. We are all kind of collectors of things, different stuff. Our garage wasn't a car. It just was stuff. I don't rather admit. And so Now I have the storage shed, which I often talk about that, but it's been different. And it's a burden. I'll tell you what, it's a burden. I don't watch a lot of those shows about giving up your stuff because that's scary for me. I have to face that, but I'm getting way better. And Grace helps me with that too. It just really decided. So yeah, safety, cardboard boxes are a big no for me. Just some good solid plastic totes.
You are like that guy in The Graduate, just yelling plastics. That's the way to go. I think that's very wise. How's that for a dated reference? Yeah, I've mentioned in the podcast before, years ago when I had my massive Power of the Force collection and I was trying to get some money so I could go live in London briefly with my fiance at the time, now my wife. I don't remember what I pulled out to sell. and I packed up the rest of my Power of the Force, and they are still in a storage unit in my old home of Minnesota, and I can't wait. I can't wait to open those boxes, Ken, because beyond a handful of figures, we talk about Power of the Force figures, and I don't remember.
Did I
know I had that guy. Do I still have a Ketwall? I don't know. And someday I'm going to open that box, and it's going to be such a great surprise. I try to approach my collection. You've been very wise at paring down. I kind of try to approach it as these bring me joy now. I like having them. Eventually, someday, they will go to someone else who brings them joy. And I am a keeper of them. They're not like mine. I get to keep them for now. And eventually, in whatever way, I will pass them on to somebody else who will also love them. Mm-hmm. Final thought for me on this one is my wife and I on a podcast were kind of joking. And then she was like, I will do this. Yeah. We came up with the idea that she would take all my action figures. Mm-hmm. And then it would be like a subscription service. She would mail me an action figure I already own each month, and I could get the surprise of rediscovering an action figure I own.
I would love that. Get your Scrimshaw box today.
Do you already own it? Well, we're going to mail it to you. Own it again for the first time. Great question, Alejo. Any final thoughts from you, Ken?
No, it's, you know, I often, my storage shed is full of, I have like a golf bag, I have some podcasting chairs that are broken in there. So I can't just walk in there like I want to, but there's days I'll go in there and just open it up and it's outside and I have to get a key. It's an effort. It's an effort. Life is hard. I'll go out there and Joseph, I just stand. I don't even open the boxes. I just look at them. So there's a lot of Funko Pops in there. I kind of miss him. And then I walk out and I'm fine.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, someday we will have the Force Center Museum and it'll be great.
Love it.
A great question, Alejo. Moving on to a question from Michael Gibbons. Michael says, when we first meet Han Solo in A New Hope, Ben Kenobi offered him a whole lot of money. My question is pretty simple. Do you think Ben even had the credits? He's been living as a hermit for the last 20 years. I don't know how much cash he would have earned trading with the occasional Jawa. This is a great question. I have thoughts, but I want to hear your thoughts, Ken.
I think there's a lot of things, and this is influenced, as I've been mentioning on Force Center for the last couple of weeks. I've been like slowly rewatching the Daniel Craig Bonds at a, you know, cardio session at a time in my gym, on my treadmill. I just finished Skyfall this morning, by the way.
Ooh, I need to talk with you about Skyfall.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely love it. You just anything with Albert Finney in it, I'm good. And, you know, I think it's Quantum of Solace that his card gets rejected. It might even be Casino Royale. I can't remember. At one point, again, I've been watching these literally 15, 20 minutes at a time over the course of 3 weeks here. I love there was one point where, like, the card gets rejected. Sir, it doesn't work. He just, like, bolts. It's like, come up. So these double O's, you know, have a card. And this has come up recently. I've seen on Twitter, right? Of like, where do the Jedi get their money? The High Republic era, this is something we ask about. And maybe we don't want that answer. I think one of the last things that Obi-Wan does in Revenge of the Sith, we don't see it, is he empties his account. And he transferred it to some offshore account, Tatooine bank, and he has it, and he's saving, there's some saving for a rainy day. The rainy day being, I got to get Luke off planet, or I got to go help, or my mission, you know, is I've been called into action. And I think along the way, I think Ben Kenobi has gone through what you and I just were talking about. I think he's got some mementos he shows up to Tatooine with, and he's slowly been giving them away and trading them away. And I think by the time we see him in New Hope, the stuff he does have displayed are like, he's like, well, these are the things that I have emotional connection with.
He's got some junk in his hut.
Yeah, he does. The rest he stole the Jawas. Like, you need a clone pauldron, take it. Clone armor pauldron, take it. I'll trade it. So I think he's become very good at trading. He probably has a tab at Chalmers. He's run up. But I think he's got some money saved. I think he does have it. And I think he knows he's got he knows that you save us. You get us to Alderaan. Bail's got me covered. Like, I think in his head at that point, he's got that too.
Yeah, no, I really love this idea that in the scene that is, you know, very sad and emotional, where he goes into the archives and he reconfigures the message to warn Jedi to stay away, that there's a little scene we missed where Kenobi says to Yoda, and like, and also I've wired all Jedi wealth to this secret account on Ord Mantell. I've sent our money to the space Caymans. Yeah. I like that idea. This is kind of fascinating of how Ben gets by. And I think all that hermit stuff and maybe even the junk in his in his hut, I think maybe he does go out like scavenging, right? So he can so he can trade with the Jawas for the basics or that kind of thing. But my take is that he has nothing. I think we kind of see this in A New Hope, that he offers 2,000 is the down payment because he's pretty sure he can sell Luke's speeder for that much. Because, you know, he says right away, we'll have to sell your speeder. I don't think that's like, I don't think that's Ben going like, we're not touching my money. So we're selling your speeder, kid. Like, I think it's really the down payment. Like, that's his great negotiation of like, oh, you want 10,000. That's already an egregious amount, according to Luke. Well, I'll give you this piddly down payment. And then the thing that's really fascinating to me is that, you know, Kenobi either knows or is just keeping his fingers crossed that Bail is still good.
Yeah.
For the other, you know, a huge chunk of money, the 15,000, right? Because it's 17,000 total, right?
Yeah. You and I both have answered that correctly at one point in our careers.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think it's we're totally seeing it in the movie that Kenobi got nothing. He gets Luke to sell the down payment for 2,000, and he knows that Bail slash the Alderaan slash the rebellion is good for the rest. And Luke says she's rich too, you know. And then we see Han loading up his reward.
We do, yeah.
So he does get paid. But it also really it really amuses me to think like Kenobi is one with the Force. Han and Luke and Leia show up, and of course the focus is on the plans, but then there's like, this debt is outstanding to get in. And Dodonna's like, Kenobi said we'd pay how much?
Exactly.
Bail's not even here. All right.
These are the fun things, and Michael, you're making me think of them because I think you're right. I think the answer is kind of, around that speeder, but the idea of Ben, when he feels Alderaan go, it's just kind of him going, oh, no, I can't cover the money. Oh, are you okay, Ben? There's 1,000 voices crying out. Oh, God.
Yeah.
Oh,
man. Millions of voices and billions of credits. Yeah.
Yeah.
The finances of Star Wars are so fun because, you know, it's a big theme. It's greed and financial greed in particular is so important to Lucas in the storytelling of Star Wars, but then you also kind of have to take a light touch on it. Like, you know, it works great in Solo when it's something cool, like hyperfuel standing in for money, you know, but it is, you got to be careful or it does become very, very real world.
Yes. Yes.
Great question. Very, very fun, Michael. Moving on to our questions from our patrons on Patreon. This one comes from Garrett McDowell. Garrett says, I've been recently watching the fascinating interview docu miniseries McCartney 321 on Hulu. For those who have not had a chance to watch it, it's an in-studio conversation between former Beatle, Paul McCartney, and legendary music producer Rick Rubin, who's worked with a wide array of artists ranging from Jay-Z to Metallica. Along with watching this, I've recently also enjoyed rewatching the various bonus feature materials of the making of the prequel trilogy, which are not on Disney Plus, but are on disc 2 of the prequel trilogy DVDs. That, kids, is why you hang on to your physical media, says Garrett. Mm-hmm. Good advice, I say. But watching those both so close together got me thinking. If we were to get a Star Wars equivalent series in which we would see a Star Wars creator and another industry legend talk about the behind-the-scenes making of the films, who would your dream pairing be? For myself, considering the 50th anniversary of Lucasfilm, I would love to see a conversation between George Lucas and Peter Jackson, who has been very open about the influence Star Wars has had on him, not just as a storyteller, but as a filmmaker on the cutting edge of visual effects. Thank you both for taking my question, and I look forward to hearing your picks. Ken, this is very much up your alley with the Paul McCartney, the Peter Jackson. What are your thoughts?
And Rick Rubin, who produced some of my favorite Johnny Cash records and Neil Diamond records. And
did Rick Rubin do those later Johnny Cash albums?
He did later American recordings. He also worked with Neil Diamond on 12 songs. I believe it was. I'm double checking as I'm doing some typing there. But yeah, and then one of my favorite albums of all time is Wildflowers, which is Tom Petty, and Rick Rubin did that. I love Rick Rubin. I wish to God he'd put shoes on during this McCartney show.
So you have watched it.
I have watched it. It is great. And I'm kidding, of course, but it's how he works in the studio. But he has shorts and no shoes on the whole time, the entire interview. And I'm just like, put some shoes on. But that's just me. No, kidding. Garrett, this is a great question, and I love it. Man, I got to tell you something. I went all over the place with this, Joseph.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Take me on a tour. Where'd you start?
I went with a just kind of, you know, it's obvious and it may be even boring. Give me Dave Filoni and George Lucas. Mm. Give me in this setting, shoot it black and white like this McCartney series. We hear it. We hear that. We God bless Dave. We hear all the time. Well, when I work with George, we know it. And I'm not even meaning that in a snarky sense. We get the stories. But to actually see them, and there is kind of anytime you see them interact, like on a stage or a panel, there's a little bit of father-son kind of playfulness. George kind of always poking at him in a fun way. But to actually see them talking about myths and Star Wars and what was there. And that now famous Filoni Duel of the Fates prequel speech for the Mandalorian series. To actually have that with George, it seems like an obvious answer, but I actually would really like to see that.
Yeah, no, that would be really, really interesting, too, to also just kind of see if there'd be some, not just Filoni really interviewing Lucas, but Lucas interviewing Filoni about, you know, where, because Filoni is very clear on, like, I want to, you know, value the legacy of Star Wars, but I want to push it to some new spaces. And I think you really can see Filoni's personality and his take. And, you know, you can talk about surface levels, like he likes wolves, so he's put some wolves in Star Wars. But there's some other, like the way he handles very specific things of the Force, like that's Filoni, you know, and it's inspired by Lucas. So it'd be amazing to see if you get Lucas to be asking Filoni about his take on Star Wars.
Yeah. Again, it's kind of an obvious, you like the Beatles? Do you also like to food, which was a great bit by a comedian named Howard Kramer years ago. I don't want to sound like I'm taking it at all, but it would be my number one answer.
Yeah. Well, where did you go from there?
So then I didn't go to Sego because the Peter Jackson, George Lucas one is great. I love that idea. I got kind of one of those. But I also would like to see Harrison Ford and Alden Ehrenreich actually sitting around and talking about crafting a character in Star Wars or even out without Star Wars. Just them talk about acting. And we know Harrison seems to be from public comments pretty happy and supportive of Alden as Solo. Just to have them as actors discussing building this character and what's there and what they feel is there, which is sometimes a little different. You know, headcanon that the actors have to have stories, you know, Emilia Clarke saying, I wrote pages about Kira and everything. And it all factors into their decisions as performers. But to hear those two guys talking about crafting this classic character.
Oh, that's great. That's great. And did you have another?
Final one for me. Is John Williams and Ludwig Göransson sitting down and just talking about that. And Williams is great. He's also pretty particular. And working with him can be, I'm told, intimidating just on principle, but also on, hey, John having some thoughts on what Star Wars is and as he should. And to have that guy at 90 now, the guy who's created the secret sauce of Star Wars, as George says, talking with someone who's not just one of the new, you know, Giacchino and John Powell have already done some work. Kevin Kiner, obviously, deserves a lot of credit and maybe a space at the table. But Ludwig Göransson is doing something so different, but it's still so Star Wars and hits the right note. Just to have these two entire different generations, these two entire different takes that really do align, I think that'd be a fascinating conversation.
Absolutely. There's so many great work across the board, but there's something about that Mandalorian main theme that's just iconic and it's going to live on, right? Yeah. It's, you know, it's, yeah, yeah, that would be amazing. Those are great picks. I got two. One, I think it would be really interesting. It would definitely cause a lot of discourse. But I'd be fascinated to see Kevin Feige and Kathleen Kennedy talk. One, to just really illuminate her history, you know, that her resume is massive and so fascinating, right? But I also think, you know, the two of them talking together, you know, this is probably not a thing that would happen while they're really actively still doing it. But these two super producers.
Yeah.
Discussing with each other what that job actually is and to maybe kind of pierce that veil a little bit. So fans who do like to really talk about behind the scenes, get a better handle on what producers really, truly actually do. What choices do they make? You know, what choices don't they make? You know, all that kind of stuff would be fascinating.
And the YouTube videos would be interesting.
That yes, that there would it would definitely cause some discourse. It's my positive rumination way to say that. But the one I want with all my heart, the one that popped in my mind immediately, and this is because of my great interest in both creators, is a moderated conversation between George Lucas and David Lynch. Now,
yeah.
the two creators who in terms of film storytelling have influenced me the most. There is a chance that they would just stare at each other. So you got to have it moderated. Because they're both not actually big talkers. They yeah. talk in their movies. But the thing that I absolutely love about them, there's that great clip of Lynch telling the story of Lucas asking him to direct Return of the Jedi. And boy, and funny videos about it. And I love the jokes. But, you know, you got to remember that this was not Blue Velvet, Twin Peaks, Mulholland Drive, flames and curtains and monkeys. Yeah. David Lynch. He had made the art house film Eraserhead, that was just totally art house, totally people only knew it existed because of very popular midnight showings. And then he got, you know, promoted immediately to the big time and made Elephant Man, which was serious Academy Award nominated, you know, Oscar bait. And that's where he was at in his career. It looked like he was just going to make a transition to like, well, yeah, no, I'm a really interesting, eclectic, strange, eccentric artist, but I'm going to do what directors do. If I made my weird little indie film, and now I'm going to become a director for hire. Yeah. That's where he was at in his career when Lucas was talking to him. And so I think them having a conversation about that, but also there's just, and this goes back to our Dune conversation at the beginning. They are so different, Lucas and David Lynch, and, you know, Star Wars and Twin Peaks, in Lynchland in general, so different on the surface, but they're generally very similar as artists. They are both auteurs who are going to try to do things the way they want. They deal with very similar themes of light and dark, living in the moment. I think they both have influences from the real world that draw them to these ideas of we as humans are connected to something larger than ourselves. And the sort of mystical of that, the empathy of that, all these great ideas that if you had a moderator who really got them talking, you know, you could get such interesting insights out of these people. And Lynch even says that in the YouTube video, where there's two YouTube videos. One is truncated and another where he tells a full story about George Lucas showing him the Wookiees. And Lynch is like, I had next door to no interest in that. But then he says, I told George, you should direct it because George makes the movies he wants to make. And the only difference between us is that millions of people want to see his movies. So even Lynch back in the day has like real respect for it. They are two auteur filmmakers, and one happens to have created this franchise that changed everything.
Yes, that's fascinating. I'm actually going to dig up that Lynch interview. I've never actually sat down to watch that one in full. And yeah, the jokes are easy to make if you follow both these careers, but I think that's a great note. And I know you're very, you know, very much of a fan of Lynch. It's great. That's an interesting point that he's at in his career. That's a wonderful conversation. Yeah. And you just stick someone, stick someone in between them.
Direct the conversation. Maybe Dwayne Dunham, who has worked with both of them. Great editor. Great question. Kind of lost my mind on talking about that Lucas Lynch connection. So thank you for that opportunity, Garrett. Great thoughts, Ken. We're going to move on to our final question then. This one comes from John and Jonathan Kenneth. This is a bit of an essay leading to the question. So strap on your essay listening hats, listeners, and enjoy Jonathan's thoughts. And then we'll get to the question and the answers. Here we go. Hey, Ken and Joseph, and hello out there, Jennifer. Thanks for such a great deep dive discussion on the relationship between The Last Jedi and The Rise of Skywalker. This is a podcast we did a little while ago. If anybody hasn't heard and is interested in that, back to Jonathan. I confess that no Star Wars film has tested me as much as The Rise of Skywalker. It has sent me back to the counseling couch more than once. But discussions like this one, in which you tackle the disparities and the resonances between the two films, as well as sincerely explore the depths of thematic enrichment that Rise of Skywalker brings to the saga, has helped me to appreciate its function as part of this vast, glorious tapestry that we love so dearly. The kind of discussion that reminds me to quote Leslie Headland, there is only Star Wars. In that spirit, I wanted to highlight an incident where Rise of Skywalker did something that retroactively altered the meaning of one of The Last Jedi's best scenes and changed it for the better, deepening the meaning of every glance, every gesture, every frame of film. For my money, there is no more powerful scene in all of Star Wars than when Luke's hands Leia Han's dice in the base on Crait. Leia tells Luke that she knows her son is gone, and he reminds her no one's ever really gone. He puts his hand in hers, and there's this glorious close-up of Leia's startled face that says, How are you doing this? Then Luke looks at her with a slight nod of the head as if to say, take a look, and she opens her hand to reveal the dice, then back to Leia's face, some enigmatic combination of resignation and resolve as she watches her brother rise to face down the whole First Order with a laser sword. This scene was powerful enough to induce tears entirely on its own, but then Rise of Skywalker adds a dimension to the scene that amplifies its power a whole order of magnitude by making explicit what we had all assumed to be true, that Luke had trained Leia long enough and well enough that she could best him with a lightsaber during a sparring session. So it stands to reason she knows all about various Jedi powers and the toll they can take. That means there is something else happening in that scene on Crait. Leia knows in the moment that Luke is going to die. With that context, the scene becomes almost unbearably moving, as we can now see that they share two secrets. Luke isn't actually on Crait, and he never will be. Now, when I look at Leia's startled face, I see it tinged with instant grief, and when I look at Luke's face, I don't see an urging to open her hand. I see a sad and moving reassurance, a once broken man who feels he failed his sister, looking at her as if to say, in their final moment, don't worry, I know what I'm doing, everything's going to be okay. And the dice are no longer just a symbol of Han, they are totemic of Luke's impending ascension into the Force. When Luke says no one's really gone, he's not just reassuring Leia about Ben, he's preparing her to accept what he's about to do, and when I now watch the glances they exchange, I can't help but hear these words in my head, but you'll die, nothing can stop that now. This is now, for me, a shared moment of profound loss that binds two generations of Skywalkers together, complements of a 30-second flashback in The Rise of Skywalker, and I doff my cap to J.J. Abrams for broadening and deepening the dimensions of this scene and creating a sense of culmination that binds the Skywalker saga together. The circle is now complete. So, the question is, Star Wars is full of moments we cherish that one day end up slightly augmented, if not outright changed, by a subsequent piece of media, be it a movie, television show, novel, comic book, or video game. So what's an example of a favorite moment that somehow became even better with additional context provided by a later story? What is your personal favorite and why? Thanks as always for the wonderful work and discussion and sense of community you always provide. Getting through these past 15 months would have been a lot harder without you. Thank you very much for the kind words and the deep thoughts and the great appreciation and study of that wonderful moment in Last Jedi. Ken, where do you go with this?
I just think overall, first of all, it just, thanks for sharing all your thoughts, Jonathan, and you all have got us through these last 15 to 18 months too. Having you all here in the Force Center community means a lot to us. I just love these kind of conversations when you have these conversations with friends around a hotel lobby bar or a convention lunch table, or just walking around, with a friend talking Star Wars, which I actually do. I love when someone gets new meaning or finds new meaning, can connect these big things. It's a lot of times open up to interpretation. A lot of times it can have a little bit of a headcanon flowing through. And I think generally everything here Jonathan's saying is I'm on board for. But the fine details aren't the point. The point is, I think if you continue to engage with Star Wars and look for these kind of themes and find the connections, it's not just about making these scenes work for you or making these scenes better, which I don't think is the point of what Jonathan's saying, but just it just makes it a more robust a feeling, a more experience, I should say. And I love continuing to look for that kind of stuff. And a lot of times, Joseph, when you and I will go on other shows and we talk about Star Wars in the way we often do here at Force Center. Not that it's a way unique to us. A lot of shows, a lot of people out there talk about it this way. But a lot of times I find when I talk about Star Wars in this way, the same way that Jonathan is, about, hey, this moment here, how it connects to this moment and what this new moment makes me feel, I find people react to that. And a lot of people don't look at Star Wars in that way. In this modern age of Star Wars discourse, I'm not talking about angry car guys. I'm talking about just even the general conversations often around plot points and predictions and what does that mean? And did Rey really, she snuck around like Kenobi. That means she's a Kenobi versus the themes up there. And you were, leading us in that direction early on in Force. So I'm energized by Jonathan's take on this. It excites me. And now I want to go back and look at the scene and see, do I see everything that he's saying there? I think, and I generally think, yeah, I'm on board for what he's saying here. But it draws me back to The Last Jedi.
Yeah, no, it draws me back to Last Jedi and Rise of Skywalker, and I echo everything that you said, Ken. I think that's a great way to say it. If these kind of ideas are energizing to hear from listeners, so it's great to have them. I think of this moment, the way that Jonathan's describing it, it really reminds me of, I think in some ways, the ultimate recontextualized scene for me, and maybe my favorite, but you know, Kenobi's Hut of Exposition in A New Hope, where he tells Luke this story of Anakin, and now we've seen it, and now we can watch the YouTube videos that cut it together, right? But in particular, we've talked about it a lot, that moment where just Alec Guinness as a performer just knows, like, well, this guy's lived his whole life. He did have a relationship with Luke's father. This is a heavy moment for him where he's going to tell him the truth, and he's got that great... There's so much in his performance, and you can intuit what it means when Star Wars was just Star Wars, but then it changes and it allows for growth and interpretation. And I think that same level of just emotional power is present in that scene in The Last Jedi, where I think this is a totally valid interpretation, but there's just so much quality to the acting. There's just so much depth. There's just like, there's a lifetime flowing through Luke and Leia. And it's so fun as a fan to go, What were they thinking about in that moment? What did they know? What did they remember? What we know that a deep amount of emotions and ideas are shared unspoken, and it's so much fun as fans to gravitate towards which idea resonates for me.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So to get on to Jonathan's question, what are your favorite scenes that recontextualize other scenes?
Yeah, so the question was, and he put it in all caps, a favorite moment. So I often sometimes work my way up to that actual answer. So I'm going to toss two out here, Joseph, and then maybe go into my actual big number one answer here, if that's okay.
Yeah, let's close with your big number one. You toss me your two. I'll share a couple, and then we're going to close with your big number one.
It's a concert here. Rick Rubin's producing. He's got his sandals up. I'm going to go first to... Finn in The Force Awakens at the Toonol Village, and how I love that moment early on. And you know, he's got his buddy gets shot. And that's, if you read that Before the Awakening book, it's a buddy from Academy type of situation. The blood on the helmet, and the helmet comes off, and he doesn't want to fire at the villager, and all of it's there. Kylo stares at him, he knows, and it's all there. It's all there and works on the surface in that movie, and works even below. You get it. He's having some problems, but he also freezes up and he wants to run and all those kind of things. And to go to what he goes into Rise of Skywalker about that feeling, it's why I really do love a lot of the Finn stuff in Rise of Skywalker, where I know not everyone does. But for me, it's just when he says, I got that feeling, I go back to that moment where it wasn't just simple. Oh, I got blood on my helmet from my pal. That sucks. I don't want to shoot this villager because that doesn't seem right. But it's just something working, and it's something you can't feel. And it's been building, and it's been building, and it's building. It just kind of comes to that moment where the Force is calling to him. And even to have Kylo kind of react, I'm not saying in my head, I think Kylo was like, whoa, I felt the Force. Oh, it's that guy. No, I don't necessarily think that, but it all kind of connects it, where it's like you see the feeling, and you maybe even feel Finn's feeling a little bit more now with that scene. And that's something that comes from just two pictures later.
No, this is a great one for me, because when The Force Awakens first came out, you know, I had friends who were like, Finn is Force sensitive, period. It's proven by the way Kylo looks at him.
Yeah.
And I was always like, I think that's a valid interpretation, but I'm not 100% on board, because I think, you know, the Force isn't just flowing through Force users. You know, Force users can, you know, sense it and it obeys their commands and all that more than others. But the Force is with all of us. And I always liked that moment, just as Kylo senses there's different energy than just blind obedience, and one of them has some different energy, you know?
Yeah.
And I always liked it as that. And I even kind of, you know, debated with friends of like, no, I think it's just that, you know, it doesn't have to be. And then Rise of Skywalker came out and was like, well, great, it is that. And I love it. You know, I'm thrilled to recontextualize that scene of the, you know, that film is called The Force Awakens, and for Finn, in a way, that is the moment that The Force Awakens, where something, you know, greater than just himself told him, this is wrong. I don't want to do this. This is not the path.
Yeah.
And the idea that Kylo could sense that little not massive shift in the force, not like, oh, who's the light sider, you know, not that clarity, but just feeling that, like, from a dark side perspective, there's a mild disturbance in the force.
Yeah, it's not a force proximity alert. Proximity alert! It's not
that. Yeah, there's no like Prius dark side car alarm going off in Kylo's head, I don't think. But I do love it now. I love Finn's force sensitivity. Yeah, I mean, a part of me would have liked it if we got to see farther down the road and he picked up the saber and all that. But for me, a part of what I love about Finn's journey and what I love about his force use in Rise of Skywalker is it's not all about combat. It's about knowledge and connection, and he's such an emissary of that vision of the force, of just being purely intuitive about connection and how to move forward, in the idea that it's not Kylo sensing a powerhouse, it's sensing this very intuitive presence.
I feel we could even talk about this more and more and more. I still, especially in Red Skywalker, just the idea you and I have talked about of sometimes Star Wars is telling the tale of the light and the dark, and it isn't about just the combat side of it. It's our daily choices, and it's why Palpatine is interested in who would fudge a report. You know, it's like all that kind of thing. And I think Finn does, especially in Red Skywalker, exemplifies the light side in action. And yeah, a saber in his hand would have been wonderful, without a doubt. And I hope we see that in some other way, in some other form. But I think it is he is truly connecting to the light side, and a lot of it goes back to that moment now for me.
Yeah, awesome. So that was your first runner up, right?
The bronze medal. Or maybe actually, quite frankly, that might have been the goal. We're working our way down. I don't know. The other one is, so it's connecting a few moments here. And it's funny because I know I kind of consider you the fan club of the Come On, Noor Jebel club.
yes.
The Rogue One, what is she proposing scene, which is a great scene. And everyone's heard me just talk about Raddus to the point of I literally, I'm not joking, get moved emotionally by some of the actions of Raddus. But that scene, Jyn's speech, Noor Jebel, Senator Pamela, everyone just kind of debating on what to do. I love looking at that now, going again to Rise of Skywalker. I don't mean to connect everything to Rise of Skywalker today, but the whole There Are More of Us scene with Lando, mm-hmm. and then Zori Bliss. Yes, I love that character, Zori Bliss. I love Carrie Russell in that role, but I love that rooftop scene with Poe. I really love it. And how Oscar Isaac has described about it. Sometimes it takes someone from your past to really kind of highlight who you really are, because they know you and they've been around you, or they were at the beginning and they just absolutely know you. I think we see a lot of that with Kira and Han, and even talking about Most Wanted by Ray Carson, not just Solo. And so Zori Bliss saying they win by making you feel alone. I now go back to that Rogue One scene, which has Raddus. What is she proposing? Is absolutely one of my favorite little funny, unintentionally funny Star Wars lines, all this kind of thing. But go to that scene, and everyone in there is battling the idea that they feel alone, battling that they can't go take up arms against this oppressor because it's just them, and this is not what they signed up for. It's not what they're capable of. Or some like Noor Jebel just don't believe it's a threat. And part of the reason you might not believe it's a threat is because you're afraid to actually face the fact that it is, and you might have to stand up. And so now I connect that to the Citizens Army, the Citizens Navy, the Citizens Space Force, if you will, showing up with John Williams' theme blared in the background. We talk about that moment a lot. You and I love it. But now I go back through Star Wars, and you even look at the rebel cells who had to be alone. They had to not know that Phoenix Squad was here and all these other cells, because it was just plausible deniability and strategy. But you felt alone until you were connected, and that was the power of being connected and with other folks in this united cause. So I go to that Rogue One moment a lot more now, thinking about There Are More of Us and how the victory in Rise of Skywalker is more complete.
Yeah, that is great. Yeah, and that feeling of being alone, you know, that is a such an understandable fear, but it is another manifestation of fear, right? Of like,
yeah,
I can't move forward because I'm alone, you know, mm-hmm. and that's what I love about Noor Jebel, is because it is such a realistic fear. His actual quote is, "A Death Star? This is nonsense." Yeah. He's not even being rational. He's in denial.
He doesn't want to hear it.
I can't cope with the horror of that reality, because then it would mean we have to make this really scary choice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So great, great moment. That's awesome. Fully agree with that one. I think for me, really, really hard to boil it down to favorite scenes, because there are so many. So I'll just highlight a couple. I think in general, in The Last Jedi, I think one of the things I really love about Last Jedi is giving the prequel era its due by having both Luke and Yoda in their own way wrestle with the mistakes and reflect on the growth of the Jedi. And I think sometimes when people talk about Last Jedi, I think they like it because they feel like it's people just acknowledging like, yeah, the Jedi are a mess. But I feel like The Last Jedi is about let's look at the mistakes that have been made and find a way forward. And that's what I love about them. So I think in terms of just pure recontextualization, you know, Yoda saying to Luke, the greatest teacher of failure is, you know, that's about Luke's recent failure with Ben. But then, you know, you keep that in mind and you watch Revenge of the Sith and you watch poor Yoda in his little jumpsuit saying, failed I have, into exile I must go. That's that. There's a direct connection of like, Yoda isn't just, yeah, Luke, I'm the master. I know everything. He's really treating Luke as somebody who needs advice, but Luke is now a peer.
Yeah.
Because they're both mentors, right? And that's why it's the we of, you know, we are what they grow beyond, you know, it, which is Yoda really also saying to me, you grew beyond me. I wasn't sure if anybody could ever come back from the dark side. I was concerned about attachment, but you taught me something, you know?
Yeah.
I think that I think about those connections now when I watch moments of Yoda in both Revenge of the Sith. Well, all of Yoda's moments, really.
Yeah.
I think other moments of recontextualization for me are there may be more about connection of the more hopeful proclamations of being a Jedi, right? Of Luke saying in Return of the Jedi, I am a Jedi like my father before me. So his kind of moment of truly declaring I am a Jedi is about his journey and what he needed to face as an individual, not just defeating Darth Vader, but that he needed to face this threat of not becoming his father. And he did that. And there's that moment of pride. And there's this great, now when I watch that scene, I think about Rey's scene in Rise of Skywalker of declaring, I am all the Jedi. Because she had to, you know, defeat Palpatine and wrestle with that concrete problem. But her fear is being alone, you know? And in her sort of declaration of I am a Jedi is standing up with saying, you know, this great huge theme of Rise of Skywalker of I am not alone, you know, and we are stronger together, and her amplifying that journey. I think those scenes really speak a lot to me. Couple quick ones. Kira's saying Han is going to help Enfys Nest in the end of Solo, of just saying like, I know him, he's going to help you.
Yeah.
Now that goes through my head every time I watch A New Hope and Han turns around and shows up for Luke and shows up for Leia and shows up for the rebellion. It's just this great reminder, like that's who he is. He claims he's not going to help, but a particularly if it's an orphan that somebody is treating poorly, he's going to help you, you know? That's a real concrete one. Final one for me is in it's similar to some of your stuff, is one that people have pointed out on social media a lot of, you know, Anakin's great quote of Shmi's wisdom in episode one. Mom, you said the biggest problem in the universe is no one helps each other. It is such a statement about trying to have empathy, trying to work together to make life better for each other, for all of us helping one another to make life better for each other and ourselves. And that for me is connected to basically all of Rise of Skywalker. I understand if people who don't enjoy the film, but I feel the film is so clear on this theme of not one, two, not too many, you know. They want you to feel alone. You are not alone. You know, we Lando saying we won because we had each other, and that great culmination of Rey feeling the support and the embrace of all the Jedi, and the galaxy having the Citizens Fleet show up. You know, it's all so there, and it all is all so in Shmi's wisdom. It's like the galaxy listened to Shmi.
Well, I love it. You actually touched upon one that I was almost going to talk about, which was Yoda. And then you did talk about one that is my top choice today, which is Han returning. And to go into a little bit more, you're so right. The Kira thing, again, because Kira knows him and Kira's been around him, and Kira knows what's at his heart, even when Han doesn't want to face it, which is a lot about what Han's journey is. He's going to run away. He doesn't want to, you know, he'd probably look at Nora Jabal and be like, yeah, I get it. Let's turn around. But that, at the end of the day, that's not at his heart. And so when he does return in, at the end of New Hope, I think about that final moment. You know, Solo's the appreciation for Solo continues to grow, thankfully, for the movie. That moment with Emphis at the end where she's kind of like, you know, hey, you're pretty good in a fight, kid. We could use you, which is something Han does many ways himself later on, which is her saying, hey, you know, something bigger you can plug into. And Han, it's not right for Han at that time. And I've joked about it. You and I have joked about some of the headcanon conversations where I really do feel Chewie is going to look at Han as they're flying away. Driving away in their Winnebago, but flying away. shout out to Spaceballs, I guess. Flying away from Alderaan with the cash prize there. I got to think Chewie's like, we've been doing this too long. And I really believe in those conversations. It's headcanon for me. But just going back to, he had that shot. Emphis asked him, gave him a chance. And didn't force it on him, didn't batter him over the head with it. Maybe she knew too what was in his heart, and the right time would emerge, and it does for Han. And so his return, his wahoo, and what made the fans in the theaters in 1977 explode with applause has great meaning. It had great meaning then, has even more meaning now for me, of him finally saying, I can't keep doing this. I'm going to make this big choice. I'm not going to leave him hanging like I left Emphis.
Yeah. I mean, in this real, almost direct connection between Kira and that great moment where Leia says, I knew there was more to you than money, yeah. Right? Like, yeah. She's getting to know Han the way Kira did. That is great. We could go on and on with these connections and these moments that recontextualize another moment, because there are so many, and I think it's, you know, it's easy to make the it's Star Wars, it's poetry, it rhymes joke, and it's fun to have that joke, but I think that is so much on purpose, you know, that it is a part of this generational storytelling, that these scenes get these ideas get revisited and recontextualized, and that's a part of what makes it feel mythic, and that generations face similar problems, but different problems, and it grows and it changes. And I think it's beautiful. Any final thoughts on this, Ken?
Yeah, great questions today, as always. I love digging deeper, even when you sometimes think you've talked about Admiral Raddus and that scene over and over and over again. You find something else that moves you.
Yeah, you know, I got to do that on the day-to-day basis. You know, when I'm making those small choices, like, do I want to be a Raddus or do I want to be a Nora Jabal? Slap down my fin and say, I can do some exercising today.
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks for the great questions. Ken, do you want to let people know where they can find us?
Absolutely. We are on Twitter at Force Center Pod. We're on Instagram, YouTube as well. Facebook page is Force Center Podcast. Podcasts available on Anchor, iHeartRadio, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Amazon Music and Spotify as well. You can get merch at tpublic.com/user/Force Center. We'll think about adding some of those new shirts, like don't be a knower and all those kind of things. you can support us directly at patreon.com/Force Center. We appreciate the support over there. You can follow me at Ken Napsok or go to my website at kennapsok.com. I have been focusing recently on the International Rescue Committee's, the organization that is taking donations right now for the stuff going on in Ethiopia, specifically the Tigray region. You can go find out more information at help.rescue.org. And Joseph, what do you have?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok is at Joseph Scrimshaw, and check out my website, josephscrimshaw.com, for all my other comedy adventures. I wanted to highlight a new thing to support this week, and it is AmericanForests.org. So it is addressing the climate crisis in general, but also just the health of our planet from the perspective of trees. One thing in particular that they do and that you can support is they are really examining trees in urban spaces and how much of a difference they make on lots of levels, from just how the aesthetic beauty affects people, but also like the difference between living in shade versus not, just all of these health benefits that truly, truly make a difference in people's lives and help the environment. It's a great, for me, it's a very Star Wars thing, because it is looking at a piece of nature and saying, we're all connected to this. And if we plant more of this nature, it helps us all. So if you're interested in reading up more on that and possibly contributing, again, you can go to AmericanForest.org.
Wonderful, wonderful idea. All right, that's it for this week. Another Force Center in the books. We'll see you next time here on Force Center.
The softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.